Blog Talk Radio. We are not alone. And welcome to another episode of Contact Radio, featuring Leslie Mitchell Clark and co-host Wes Roberts, where we explore ufology and beyond with the help of the world's foremost experts. And without further ado, here's your host and your guide, Leslie Mitchell Clark. And a very, very enthusiastic Happy New Year to all of our listeners out there in ufology land. This is your host, Leslie Mitchell Clark, and I am joined happily by my co-host and partner in crime, Mr. Wes Roberts. Wes, hello, how are you?
Hey, Leslie, I am great, and I should tell our listeners we are having a gay old time a little earlier, talking total ufology and about what's going to happen this year.
Boy, there are some very exciting plans afoot, as Sherlock Holmes would say. Mm-hmm. And we'll be able to reveal more about that later as we continue on. But we have been, throughout December, just to give ourselves a little regrouping time and also to highlight some of our very favorite shows, we've been running previously aired episodes of Contact all through December. But we are live, all the way live. And I actually have my blood pressure unit here, which I can put on you, Wes, to make sure that you're live.
Well, I'm actually quite relaxed having spent an evening with yourself and Terry.
All right, all right. Well, the sphygmomanometer is here in case any of us doubts if we're in the corporeal. But yes, we are here and we are all the way live and we are welcoming all of you to the program. We have a lot of exciting guests lined up for this month and next month and beyond. So we hope you're going to tune in and spend some time with us every Sunday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Now, this evening, we are absolutely delighted to welcome back to Contact one of our very favorite guests, a noted journalist, media consultant, MUFON administrator, and author of Incident at Pleasant Ridge, A Canadian UFO Mystery, Intrusion, Alien Encounters, and also his brand new ufology-themed book, which I have just read, actually, and it's fantastic, and it's called What If? Close Encounters of the Unusual Kind. And, of course, I am talking about Bob Mitchell. And we are so very pleased that he is joining us this evening on Contact. And fantastic that we have Bob this evening because he's a perfect guy to kick off the year. His most recent book, as are his other two books, more or less a compendium, I would say, of experiences, contact, and J. Allen Hynek, of course, delivered the scale of contact, close encounters of the first kind, the second kind, the third kind, the fourth kind. And Bob Mitchell's latest book, which I think is just fantastic, really covers all of those types of encounters, from the most interdimensional, almost conceptual spiritual encounters to encounters that are very much physical and based in our third dimension. So it is a compendium of experience, and the people are incredibly credible that he has interviewed, many of them actually colleagues of ours, and in fact, if I may say, yourself, Wes Roberts, you have contributed to Bob's book. So we're very, very thrilled to have him here. And I see by my little virtual switchboard that I think Bob is on the line. I'm going to pick up the phone right now and see if that is him. Cousin Bob, is that you?
Yes, it is. How you doing, Leslie?
All right, folks, we are so pleased to have Bob Mitchell on the line with us. And as I mentioned, he has just recently released the third ufology-focused book in his retinue. Of course, he is a multiply published author. Bob was, for many years, a correspondent or contributing writer to the Toronto Star. He covered crime and also sports and various other things. But his third ufology book, called What If? Close Encounters of the Unusual Kind, has just been released. And let me just say now, it is available on Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. Bob, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
My pleasure, Leslie. And how are you tonight? And how are you, Wes?
Oh, very well. And really, really excited about your book. And not just that it's been so well received, but an interesting cross-section of folks like myself and folks very much on myself.
Indeed. In fact, I must compliment you, Bob, on how you... Now, you must have had, you know, a dearth of material from various, you know, sources and people with their encounters and their stories. But in this book, you have really managed to get a great cross-section of the really many different kinds of experiences that people do have in the realms of extraterrestrial encounters.
Yeah, I did, and I think I was lucky in that, because when I set out, as usual, I have no idea what I'm going to, you know, end up, what it's going to look like at the end. But the people that I tracked down and ones that came to me that wanted to tell their story, it just seemed to fall into place because they, as you said, each one of them has a completely different experience. And none of them really have ever told their experiences before. This is the first time that it's been, you know, down on pen and paper. Or not pen and paper anymore, but computer.
The metaphorical
tablet,
quill, but, Bob.
Yeah, yeah, and it I just found it amazing that that they were so diverse. But the one thing that I found in this book, unlike the last book that I did, was that there seemed to be a theme of reincarnation or. A transforming into other beings that seem to run right through this book for most of the characters other than a couple of them, which I totally never expected. And now it's given me a whole new, look at the phenomena.
Indeed. And you know, I might want to interject here that in keeping with what you're talking about, you know, as a hypnotherapist who works extensively in regression, it is not at all unusual, Bob, for individuals during, say, a regression to, let's talk about a past life regression or an interlife regression, where someone is experiencing or remembering what happens in the life between lives. It is very, very common for individuals to go through a process where they will face, perhaps you could call it a council, a benevolent council, and where they say their former life and what they want to accomplish in any coming physicalizations. Now, these councils are quite frequently peopled by beings of certainly beyond or in addition to humanoid experience. It is not at all unusual for people in the afterlife who are experiencing the afterlife, at least through regression, to encounter and interact with what we would call extraterrestrial beings, which tends to lend credence to the idea that we are indeed one big soul pool, if it were, and that we, reincarnation, that we can incarnate into multiple worlds, into multiple bodies.
Yeah, I mean, I had no idea that this concept was out there. And when I, you know, one of our good friends who's in the first chapter, who I'm not using his real name right now because he didn't want to, but I'm using his Himalayan name, which is still his real name. But, I mean, he was floored when he found out that you could reincarnate not only here on Earth, but also as a being in another universe or even another dimension. And I know Wes has had many, many experiences where he's now convinced that that what we see here on Earth is just only part of the puzzle.
Yeah, it seems to be that way, Stu, absolutely. And And also, you know, well, we're talking about, you know, what the, in the first chapter of your wonderful book, you do talk, it's in depth about Mr. Ananda, who is someone known to us, who has had an experience with a being or series of beings that would be categorized as perhaps insectoids or mantoids.
Yeah, and he had never even, when he had that experience, you know, our your listeners must realize, to him, an alien was a gray. He had never heard of an insectoid. He never heard of the mantis. So it wasn't even in his mind even to conjure up this being. And when this being suddenly appeared during one of his out-of-body experiences, it was a completely new phenomenon to him. And then when he found out that that not only had they been together in that insectoid form at some point in a previous life, but they would be together again, not in a human form, but in an insectoid form, it really, I think, changed his life even more than his life has already been changed.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. And I don't remember if I've discussed this with you or not, Bob, but there was a client that has come to see me a number of times, a colleague known to Wes as well, who has I guess you would say that he's a person who's been involved in sort of the MELAB end of the experiential mm-hmm. things that can happen to people, as sort of a combination of human military investment and maybe multiply agended ETs, who knows. But within his experiences, he has had an ongoing relationship with a being that he calls Kern, who is identical to the description of the insectoid being that we read about in your first chapter. And this
really?
Being Kern, just like the being described in your book, emanates love and support and acceptance, is kind of a being of pure love, which for most people, very hard to equate a physicality, an insectoid physicality, with a high, high level of spirituality and love.
Well, absolutely. And I think two or three of the people in my other book, Intrusion and Alien Encounters, I mean, they had the same feeling. But when they had the experience, it never occurred to them there was a reincarnation or a past connection, although they each thought that they had some kind of connection to them, but they couldn't figure it out. And now, having, you know, done this book, I'm wondering if their connection had to be a reincarnation too, and that explains this love that they were an insectoid and they were their partner or mm-hmm. parent or child or some connection, because that would explain why I think I don't know of anybody who's had an experience with an insectoid creature that hasn't had this overloving experience.
Yes.
And that's the only thing I can think of, that it's a reincarnation experience.
Well, it's completely probable, in my way of thinking, simply because this is something that I do hear about, you know, more or less repeatedly. And even in the material, you know, in Len Kasten's phenomenal book, The Secret Journey to Planet mm-hmm. Serpo, which is about an exchange program that happened in the 60s between a team of astronauts from the secret space program here in the United States, who exchanged places with beings from the planet Serpo, who call themselves Ebens, who are a hybrid race. They're humanoid, but they have gray elements as well. At any rate, in his book, he talks about how they eat in this cafeteria, for lack of a better term, like a group eating place.
Part.
And at a certain point, you know, he saw an insectoid being, you know, what, 8 feet tall or whatever, were in a robe, more or less levitating around the tables. And this being was just an accepted, diplomat or representative.
Yeah, just like somebody just come in for a visit and wasn't a big deal.
Right, no big deal. Just here they go. They're not eating necessarily, but they're floating around and they're cool. And
yeah. And it, in fact, it was Len's book that sort of got me thinking about the title of my book, What If, because I just thought that that was such an incredible story that he told. I thought, well, what if it's true? What if his story is so true that would change our entire lives? It would be a game changer. It would change the way we look at the society. It would change the way we look at our governments. And so when I wrote this book, I was looking for stories that would be on the same line, that if all of the people in my book are telling the absolute truth, then that certainly would be a game changer. But then I end up with Cinta, Neja, and Arat, that sort of I struggled with throughout the book, because her story is completely different than most stories that deal with aliens. And as I say in the book, that if she's right, everybody else is wrong. That is hard for me to comprehend, but what if it is? And even if she is in touch with some being, what if they're not telling her the truth? And then that opens up a whole other can of worms about why they're not telling her the truth.
Well, indeed, we could easily have, we can have beings that are only sharing partial truths with us. We could have beings that have different agendas, who are, manipulating us. All this is possible. I think that's in the minority. I think most of the experiences that people have are positive, although they may not interpret them that way because of the confused memories. And I also think, and I've expressed this to Wes many times, my personal feeling about having done a lot of regression work is that I think most suppressed memories are sort of time-dated, if you will, and that they cannot be suppressed forever. I do not believe that any of this trickery with our engrams, any of this stuff that's used to suppress memories, I don't think any of it can last indefinitely. We are so curious. I do not think that the ETs have a complete understanding of how our brains work, but we are, and this was explored by Gene Roddenberry, of course, in many episodes of Star Trek, we are curious. We are curious and we are relentless. That is one of the things about Terrans, if you will. So it's not unusual, or I should say rather, I have very few people coming to see me to explore their suppressed memories who are in their 20s.
Yes, we're all in their 50s, you imagine, right?
Yeah. It would be very, from 40 on up, this seems to be when things start to percolate. So my feeling is that, well, maybe we are able to receive the information when we're ready to receive the information. So these so-called, memory blocks or whatever are not these, evil, controlling things that paranoids would assume. They're not that at all. We simply are given time to adjust to the information that inevitably percolates up.
Yeah, or the other possibility, as one of my experiences thought in my last book, was that they're just getting better at it. They know how to control the mind so much now that the younger people have no idea that they're being abducted or are being visited. They have that much control over now, whereas the older people, they didn't have that much control, and now it's just coming out. But I think either theory is quite valid.
Well, I think the young people coming in are much more amenable to these experiences. If you know what I mean, they live in a more altered kind of reality. And I don't know about, I know both of my sons, they're now, grown up and, doing responsible things, but they both experimented with hallucinogenics and other things. There were no hallucinogenics in 1956. Really, there was, it was a big deal when I was a kid if we smoked a cigarette. I don't think we were as used to traveling in altered states, maybe, as the kids coming in.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is fascinating to try to figure out why more people from 40 on seem to like, well, they seem to be more willing to talk about what they had hidden for all these years now. And I don't know what triggers it, but definitely people I've talked to, something triggered their desire to finally come out of the closet, so to speak.
Yes. Yes, and this is so typical, Bob. It is so typical. I think those memories are just percolating. And when it's time, when the person can accept, you know, whatever happened. And the good news is that once you get in there and once you uncover, you know, whatever has been suppressed, it's usually not nearly as you know, traumatizing or horrific as the person has imagined. You know, it's all manageable with proper integration, I think. Now, Wes, that really brings us to you and your experience, because you certainly have gone from a position of again being in midlife, having things percolate to a point where you wanted to know, you had to know. So maybe you could talk or a little bit about that.
Well, I know for myself, that's say prior to coming to see you, so we're talking beyond 5 years ago, I was struggling with this in the sense of disbelief. I would never have admitted that this was a possibility for me. I thought, well, these were just something like dreams, but I knew they weren't dreams because I know the difference. And it's possible I'm like some of those people out there, but I couldn't possibly be one of those people out there. Until finally it was like I thought I needed to understand that I had some conscious volition here, and I had some involvement, and I had some participation, and I had maybe a contribution. And I don't know if that just comes with age or maturity, or you just sort of put your foot down at a certain point and say, this is it, I'm throwing down the gauntlet.
Yeah.
And Wes, you found far more than you expected, too.
Oh, unbelievable. I think Leslie started out earlier by chatting about interlife regressions, and I've been through one. And interestingly and not surprisingly, among the assembled audience was a few aliens there to make sure that what they had agreed upon with me had taken.
Fascinating. Yeah, they were there to just ensure that. Now, Bob, Wes and my husband Terry and I were talking about this at dinner earlier, and I was, you know, we were recounting that, of course, you have a vast history as a writer of, you know, journalistic-style, reality-based books, including,
yes,
you know, true life crime. So no doubt you have interviewed many, many thousands of people, no doubt. When you are interviewing someone who has had a extraterrestrial experience of some sort, is the fact that they, I mean, what criteria do you use based on your long experience to get a feeling that it's a truthful recounting that you're hearing? I mean, I know we always hear that, you know, witnesses, if they say the same thing, if they regale the same story exactly the same way, that's a good indicator of truth. But you must have had a sense of truthfulness because of your experience. What was your process, Bob?
Well, you know, as when I started out doing UFO books, I had no idea where it was going to take me. I had no idea what, you know, that very first person in the second book, Intrusion, was going to tell me. But I quickly found out that while they might have been reluctant to start with, it just sort of flowed afterwards. And unlike interviewing, you know, crime people and sports people, the emotion that comes out of interviewing somebody that's had the experience is completely different. There are ups and downs. There's a little bit of crying. You can see tears in their eyes. You can see they're at some point, maybe they don't want to tell you something because they don't want you to think they're crazy. But after a while, they really just completely open up to everything. And they say, you know, I think in their own mind, they say they know they're not crazy. They know they've had these experiences, and they don't even care if anybody else believes them anymore. They just want to get it off their chest. And I would say every single person that's in the two last books, I felt the exact same thing when I talked to them, that there was just a sense that that this was something that's been in them for a long time, and none of them seem to be making it up. Even the, you know, Vicente Nerata, she, I didn't have the opportunity to meet her face to face. Most of it was internet and on the phone. So I couldn't get the same eye contact or anything like that. But I know she believes it to the point where she would get very upset when I tried to challenge her on things. And it just seemed to be something that she has just would not entertain the fact that she was being lied to. She's is so believes that this being is telling her the absolute truth that she doesn't want to think about the alternative. So, you know, when you're interviewing police and you're interviewing, well, you don't get a lot of chance in Canada to actually interview the criminals. Unlike the states where you know they open it up, and you know once somebody's arrested, you never get a chance to talk to them unless they agree to talk to you behind bars, and that won't happen until after they're convicted. And
that's here in Canada.
Yeah. I mean, in the states, you know, you look at Nancy Grace every night. You know, if they're interviewing people that haven't been arrested yet, but end up getting arrested, and people that the public has already said they're guilty. So Canada's a lot different. Everything is very closed. We're really a closed society here when it comes to crime and all that. But I mean, I've interviewed many professional, you know, hockey players, football players, et cetera. And, you know, they don't have the continued narrative that an experiencer has. It's just, anybody that ever gets the chance to talk to somebody who's had these experiences will understand what I'm talking about. I'm sure you understand what I'm talking about, that there's just something about them where it's believable, even though it seems far-fetched, if you want to look at it, the world around you. But I always go back to when I'm interviewing people, what Crown attorneys used to say to jurors and before they went to the jury's room to render their verdict on a murder trial, because most jurors, they feel that they're not qualified to be judges, and they kind of are scared and intimidated when they have to do this. And the Crown attorneys will always tell them that use your common sense and your life experiences. Well, when you're dealing with experiencers, unless you've had that experience, you can't possibly put yourself in their shoes.
Yeah.
But other experiencers can understand what other experiencers are going through. And I think it really helps when experiencers meet experiencers, because you see the hugs, you see the relief that comes into their eyes. And even when they were just talking to me, the relief was just almost overpowering that someone was able to listen to them without, you know, immediately saying they were nuts.
Well, that's so true. That's so true, Bob. And I'm sure you've experienced it. I'm sure that you have observed in the various experiencers that you've interviewed that we're, you know, contrary to what public opinion may hold, we are not talking about dysfunctional fringe people here with tinfoil hats. This is not what we're talking about.
That's the thing. These are all sane people that have stories that, you know, the average person might think are insane, but I bet a lot of the people that think their stories are fabricated, they're probably hiding something themselves, a lot of them, and don't want to admit it.
Indeed, and well, certainly the number of people that we think are having experiences is massive. I mean, there are some people that are of the opinion that three-quarters of the beings, people on the planet, the Terrans on the planet here, us, have had encounters. So, you know, even if someone is registering a skeptical or a snide attitude, that may simply mean that they are reacting almost like the gay thing, right? Pardon me for saying, homophobes, you know, active homophobes generally have, you know, have tendencies themselves, and what they're raging against are themselves, really.
So when I was covering, you know, crime and sports and always wanted to do a book on UFOs, I really had no idea the scope of how many people had experiences. I mean, I thought, you know, there was Betty and Barney Hill, and there was Travis Walton, and maybe a couple other people. And I thought that was it. I mean, I didn't know there could be, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions, that had these experiences. And that was really very mind-blowing and mind-opening that it's so prevalent.
In fact, right now we talk about the figure of 14 million plus, and these are reported experiences. Reported experiences. 14 million people, that's bigger than New York City. So, and these are the people that have actually, you know, filed reports or told other people or what have you. Now, Bob, what stands out to you? Of course, every chapter in your book is fascinating, but what stands out to you as maybe one of the most mind-bending experiences that you wrote about in the current book?
Well, I would say it has to be, and I've talked about it earlier, Cinta, Asia, and Narat.
Yes.
For our listeners, I'll try to give this the Cole's Notes version for Canadians who knows what that is.
Are those like Cliff's Notes?
Yeah, Cliff's Notes, yeah.
Oh.
When I was growing up in Canada, they were Cole's Notes. I think they still have them.
not from Cole's department store, though. Wasn't that a department
store?
No,
Cole's the bookstore that's in the mall.
Oh, okay.
Like Chapters. but actually, I remember using Clifton Notes, too, as going to university. We had to buy them from a specialty store. I know that.
Yep.
But at the time, I didn't realize that was an American term. But but in any event, this is a lady who's in her 50s. And to show you that she's not this fringe person, she works in law enforcement in Nova Scotia. So you have to think that to get hired for that kind of job, that there's some mental test that's done to show that she's not, some kind of wacko. So in any event, her story... The basic premise of her story is that in 2014, she started being telepathically communicated by a being who we would call a gray, but they don't call themselves grays. In fact, they don't like the term. She says they're actually not really gray. They're more of a Mediterranean hue, but the grays are just the name that most of humans call these creatures when they see them. But they're actually called the Ataraku, and they're from the Orion constellation, according to her protector, her guide, who is a being called Atu Ibu. And one of the things that she has been able to telecommunicate with them, and they've communicated with her, is that she's been told their entire life story, their history, where they're from, their society, how they live, what's on their planets, what they fly, what they don't do, what their medicine is like, their education, like everything that you'd ever want to know if you were going to another planet. She now has that knowledge, she claims, and she can also read and write their language. She's been taking telepathic tests, I guess. And the big thing that she tells me is that that the Ataraku are the only species that has ever visited Earth, because they are so far advanced than any other species out there. There are other species, but they have told her that they are not as advanced as they are and don't have the capabilities of coming to Earth, and most of them don't even know Earth exists. Now, I don't know how that falls into place with people who have experienced mantids or people who have experienced, hooded little creatures. The only thing I can think of there is when I'm the terminology visiting Earth, perhaps mantids and these other beings are spiritual oneness, interdimensional beings that their term of visiting Earth is different than what we consider it to be.
Yeah.
But and also, you know, when I ask people, I ask people just when I did before I was writing this book, I asked them, people on the street or the people that I knew, what they thought of when I mentioned the word grays, and almost all of them came back with, they're these bad dudes that have been coming to Earth and abducting humans for medical experiments and possibly a food source, and that they've been operating under agreements with governments or shadow governments that have been allowing abductions to take place so that we can get some advanced technology, and that they're the ones that the U.S. captured when Roswell happened. And the fact is, according to what she has been told, that they are nothing like that, that they are a benevolent, you know, society of three different planets that are very much like Earth-like. And they have a society that is kind of communistic, kind of militaristic. It's basically a militaristic society with a communistic type lifestyle where everybody doesn't go without and everybody has what they need and are provided with food and homes. And so what we think of the Greys definitely aren't what she says they are. I don't know. She is very strong in this, but she also, I mean, I asked her some scenarios about things that we believe have happened, such as Roswell, Rendlesham Forest, Battle of L.A., Travis Walton, and got some very surprising answers, because she did say Roswell did happen and it was them, but the bodies only lived for a couple of days, the two that survived and the others didn't. And the story we've always been told is that they lived for, you know, many weeks, and maybe they still is one kicking around.
Yeah.
And that the Battle of L.A. did happen, but she claims Rendlesham Forest never happened.
Oh, boy.
And she even claims Travis Walton didn't happen.
Those are big things to try and get past, you know. It's tough, and also, you know, when we even, you know, like the wonderful Paul Hellyer and all of our research, there are many types of grays. You know, there may be these beings that she is interacting with, but in fact, you know, and of course, again, according to the work of Len Kasten and the Ebens, and those were the beings that he says, those were the beings that were involved in the Roswell crash.
There were so many stories like that, so it's hard to figure out who's telling the truth.
And then, of course, we have the whole issue of ancient aliens, ancient astronauts, and, you know, why do we have this unusual DNA where a lot of it is a mystery? Why do we have Rh negative? Why, you know, why are the bloodlines so protected that go back, you know, beyond the European thrones? I think it seems to me, I would have to say that I feel that it's a bigger picture. But there's no doubt that she's invested in her particular journey, as it were.
Oh, my God. I mean, she is just, in the book, she has provided many drawings. She's a pretty good drawer, and the cover of the book is the Supreme Commander of the Greys. He's a 300-year-old King Attila Nera. And, you know, it's quite a striking cover, if people have seen it. My own feeling is that she believes she's in contact with this being. And if she is, I think they're lying to her. And I don't know why they're lying to her.
That would be a real interesting question, because I think that the universe, the multiverse, is filled with diverse life, and of course, you know, the beings allegedly that come from the Lyran system or the Pleiadian system are very, very physically like us. I mean, indistinguishable almost. And I think it's a bigger picture. Now, Wes, you have had encounters with various beings, humanoid, gray, if you will. And then the brown skin beings, as many people call them, the brown doctors. By the way, I don't know if you know that, Bob, but these brown beings.
Well, I didn't know that.
They're often involved.
I know the masses, some people call the doctor, but I didn't know them.
They do. They seem to be medical experts. They seem to be involved in medical procedures, the brown doctors, but they don't want anyone to really see them very clearly. But, you know, Wes has experienced, I don't know, 5, 6, 7, God knows how many different types of beings, energy
yes.
beings. But the being that he is most close to, Wes, why don't you jump in there and just explain a little
this
bit about
twin.
Your experience.
Well, I tend to call her my twin because under hypnosis, for sure, she made herself known on day one, and this was totally unexpected. I came to Leslie for a whole different reason, which was the 19A's experience, and that did not come up, at least not in the first hypnosis session. And she sort of began to make herself known that, hey, I've been with you since you were a kid. And then it also came forth, this particular thing or being that I call my twin, was connected or hooked up with Leslie when Leslie was a kid, which was really synchronistic, to say the least. And she is, I don't know what to call her, a tall white, possibly,
mm-hmm.
or a Palladian. I've seen her in several different forms, in dreams, in visions, under his but generally she's 7 or 8 feet tall, straight as a razor.
Yes, so that's another type of humanoid being. And of course, Bob, I guess we can't rule out that, and you explore this in your book, of course, that some experiences that people have are not really three-dimensional experiences. Again, we can go back to, you know, J. Allen Hynek or more accurately, back to Vallée, who
yeah.
talked about close encounters of the fifth kind as being, I would have to say, interdimensional.
Yeah, and doesn't Wes, you know, Wes, is a lot of his experience are interdimensional.
Yes, yes. And people do sometimes, Bob, there seems to be, at least in some of the cases that I've explored, there seems to be a progression of experience. In other words, when us as humanoids have early contact, sometimes it's very physical. You know, children are transported. They do move through walls or whatever, what have you. And there may be some type of examination, usually benign, some type of interaction with other hybrid children. But the things are very physical. The little kids, they wake up in the morning and their pajamas are on backwards. And, you know, this kind of thing. There's a physicality to it. It seems to, the experiences seem to morph or evolve, if you will, into a more interdimensional experience, almost of like bilocation. It seems to evolve with many people. Have you found that, Bob, in your interview?
Yeah, well, I mean, it kind of suggests there are probably, I'll give two categories of beings that are visiting Earth, if you believe in it. That, you know, you have the physical beings such as the Greys, and perhaps the reptilians, if we're to believe that that's a true species. And then there's these energy light beings and the ones that Wes has experienced, and perhaps they are interdimensional. So we're only in the third dimension. And I've had explained to me that everything around us in a different dimension has a total different quality. A flower or a rock that we see here on Earth, that same rock in a fourth or fifth or sixth dimension has a vibration to it. It's alive.
Yeah.
Only here,
yeah.
It's not alive. So I think there's definitely two different categories. It's interesting when I was talking to Wes, he always felt he was evolving into something. And
yeah.
and one of the people that's in my book, she goes by the name Josie. She had these horrible experiences where she was having, you know, nightmares every night, and then after waking up from the nightmares, she'd have another nightmare she thought it was not in her physical body, but when she was taken on board these ships, she was underwent these horrible medical experiments where she felt extreme pain to the point where one time she saw her hand go right through her body. And this was going on every night. And she told me something really strange at the end of our conversation, that the pain started going away. And in her mind, somehow she thought that she was being prepared for something, that this was a process that she had to go through in order to go to a different stage.
Oh, boy.
What that stage is, I don't know. I mean, I've never heard anybody actually explain it, those medical experiments, that way. But I think she was very scared each time. But that's the other thing is I think as you've probably had from all the people that's come to you, that not everybody has terrible experiences. Not everybody feels they've been abducted and had these medical experiments going on.
Well, I'd have to say it's very much in the minority now, Bob. I think, you know, again, this is just, you know, I'm just, you know, a stranger in the wilderness here moving about. But I think that there at some point in the not too distant past, some kind of moratorium occurred where these types of invasive medical things became disallowed. We don't see a whole lot of that happening after, say, 1962, 63. I had an experience that was very physical and very disturbing a little bit later than that, I'd say 1974. But we really don't see a whole lot of that. It's almost as if those kinds of experiences themselves were sort of shut down. And there is... there is some evidence too, and we must keep our minds open that not everybody who believes that they have had a sexually or physically invasive experience at the hands of a unnamed extraterrestrial being have actually experienced that. The memory is a very fragile mechanism. And, I know this is not a popular thing to say in ufology, but I believe there are occasions where sexual and physical abuse in our real-time world have been confused with a more acceptable, even more, acceptable rationale of, oh, yes, it was something else.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's maybe so traumatic for them that to even think that it happened to them that they're now imagining or have convinced themselves that something else has happened to them.
Absolutely.
And it wasn't their uncle or it wasn't their father and things like
That's
that.
Right.
So,
a
lot of people say it's that.
It can easily, you know, the memory is a defense. How can I put this? Our minds have a lot of defensive mechanisms, a lot of them. Multiple personality disorder is even a defensive mechanism. You know, there's endless variety, but there have been a number of occasions where people have come to me believing that they were experiencers, and it didn't take me very long to figure out that what they were actually talking about was some very terrible childhood abuse that has been masked by themselves. Into this other scenario.
I would believe that to be really a strong sense that they have, that they just don't want to admit that what really happened, that they have to find some other reason for it. It's interesting about Wes, when Wes tells about his experiences, you know, some people may say, well, that's Wes talking and you're getting it out of him, but you actually physically saw something, didn't you?
I have on several occasions experienced manifestation when Wes was here under hypnosis, and I am not the only one. There are a number of practitioners. In fact, my great friend and mentor, Dr. Georgina Cannon, has experienced seeing somebody sort of change physically, even in the process of past life regression. So I guess my feeling about that would be is we are actually very sort of plastic and malleable, and much more so than we probably think. And we can manifest, you know, past life personalities. We can manifest future life shapes. I think, now, that being said, I'm not saying that every hypnotist would perceive or experience what I have.
No,
with watching
no.
People
I would
in
think
session
it's very
transform.
In the minority, I would think.
I think so. And so I do attribute part of that maybe to my own sensitivity. Certainly Georgina Cannon is a woman of tremendous sensitivity and abilities that one might consider paranormal. So I think maybe what I see or what I feel that I see may not be physically happening in the sense that someone else could walk in the room and see what I see, but I think I can tune in maybe to the soul identity or to the
right.
to the intention or to the, you know, I think I'm allowed to see or experience certain things by some of these powerful beings. And they're very powerful beings. The being that works through Wes has incredible kinetic power. In other words, when she shows up, the temperature of my office will the heat will just like go off the tracks. I mean, it could go from, you know, a comfortable 60 degrees to almost 80 degrees Fahrenheit. So the being is has a lot of kinetic energy that is palpable to us. And
which is why Leslie, that you know you're an internationally acclaimed hypnotherapist, regressionist, and you're not, you know, on the fringe. You're not one of these crazy people. So that shows you why the title of my book is so appropriate, because what if what you're seeing, you've actually seen, that would mean the world we live in really isn't the world we think we live in. And it's exactly
right,
what I was trying to show in my book.
Well, I think, which you've done a brilliant job, and that actually is true. Here I am, you know, university educated, blah, 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 and I have had experiences with clients in my office where I have actually seen and experienced manifestation myself, which I would not have necessarily believed a few years ago. So I can absolutely tell you that that's true. But, you know, we as beings, now, that being said, I think we as physical beings, we underestimate ourselves. We are multidimensional beings. We may not have the technological facility at this point in our sociological evolution that some of these other cultures do, but we are no less important. We are no less skilled. We are no less gifted. And I think when we stop thinking of ourselves as peons, as ants, as, you know, cave dwellers, when we start being able to really accept ourselves as interdimensional souls, then we will be able to have true first contact. I think that it's we ourselves with our poor self-image and our limited scope, being masters of limitation, I think it's us that are preventing the next great phase from happening, you know, in a widespread way. We are our own worst enemies.
Yeah. And how much do we use of our brain now? What did they say, 10% or, what's in the other 90% that we haven't figured out how to use yet?
Yeah, and below the Mason-Dixon line in the southern United States, maybe it's
3%. Yeah, yes.
Sorry, Bob. Sorry, everybody down there.
Hey, well, listen, if you watch Judge Judy, you think everybody down the South is a little lost.
I know, these toothless people with bad grammar. God help us. Anyway.
I know.
But they're all sold on a different, you know, we're all on the escalator here, you know, and some of us are, you know, we're all progressing at different levels. You know, ascension is an uneven process, and I think that that is probably, as my late great dad, bless his heart, would say, that's one of the laws of the universe, that ascension is an uneven process.
Yeah, and our brain is what keeps the soul there, I think. And when we die, that's what the light and energy goes somewhere. And a lot of people are now convinced that it goes into a different being of some kind.
Well,
or comes
indeed,
back to the human. So.
Absolutely. And now, you know, with the real-time mapping of the brain and other esoteric sciences, now we really are having solid evidence that intelligence exists outside of the body. I mean, our medical science is finally beginning to prove many of the arcane things that mystics have known, you know, since time, you know, immemorial. So we're living in really exciting times, Bob. Really exciting times. Who knows what we're going to see, you know, in the next 20 years? Who knows?
Well, I think it all has to do with the mind that somehow will. And, you know, just look at the kids that are reborn today. I've got 4 grandkids now, and I can say that they seem to be smarter than we were at that age. And I think every generation somehow is getting smarter. And I don't know if they're getting smarter because we have all this technology now, but they seem to know how to operate the technology. You know, I have 2 that are, you know, 3 years old and 4 years old, and at 3 they were fully capable to use an iPad. And
oh, no kidding.
Could turn on,
they come in that
turn
way,
on
Bob.
The TV. I know. So,
they come in that
I
way.
Don't know. Our genetics are changing, I think.
Yes, or, you know, you could look at it, people are born in their proper time. These kids are coming in with what they need, and there is a school of thought that even says that the internet and all of these, you know, contemporary communications are training wheels. They are merely reflections of the way that we are going to be able to communicate without the hardware in the future. So,
oh, yeah. I mean, didn't I just read, I think I read today somewhere that Google is now coming up with AI intelligence that's going to run their system. So you just tell them, I want to book an airplane flight, and it does everything for you. Your hotel, your itinerary, and it's going to be doing everything for you. So I don't know.
Well, where can I get one of
those
to clean my house? That's what I want.
I think it would cost a little more than we're looking for at this point. But things will come down
anyway,
in price.
Bob,
look at the big screen TVs.
That's right. Well, we're just about out of time. I can hardly believe it. Now, Bob, I know that your new book, What If? Close Encounters of the Unusual Kind, is available on both Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. But I know that you have now a direct site set up for the purchase.
It's not set up for the purpose, but it's set up to let everybody know what book's out there and where to get it.
Okay.
So it's Bob Mitchell Author. simplesite.com.
Okay.
So you'll be able
Bob
to find
Mitchell
every book that I've.
simplesite.com.
So you'll be able to find every book that I have ever written, and I have. But right now, I'm just saying that it's available on Amazon.com, Amazon.ca, and international websites. I'll probably soon be able to just have a link there where people press on, and it'll take them to Amazon and then that'll be easier for them. But other than that, they just, you know, put the title of the book in when you see it on my site, and it'll tell you how to get it. So, and I'm working on another one right now.
I know you are.
Which will be, might take a little longer, but this one's earth-shattering, I think.
Okay. Well, I can hardly wait. And Bob, promise that you'll come back and chat with us about that when it's ready on Contact.
Absolutely.
Wonderful. Well, Bob Mitchell, I just want to thank you so much for joining us this evening. It has been, you know, another eye-opening, mind-bending chat. Everybody out there, please go order Bob's book, What If? Close Encounters of the Unusual Kind. And, Bob, every wonderful wish for the new year, and I look very forward. We both look forward to seeing you very soon.
My thoughts exactly.
Okay, Bob.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you so much. Take care,
yep,
and good
you
night.
You too. Have a great evening with the calls. Okay.
Thank you so much, Bob. Bye-bye now.
Okay. Bye-bye.
And thank you, everyone out there in the interweb land. This is Leslie Mitchell-Clark and Wes Roberts. We're signing off for the evening. Next week, live interview with Carl Dory, experiencer, MeLab guy. You're going to love it. Good night.
Good night, Leslie.
Good night, Wes. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Contact Radio with Leslie Mitchell-Clark and co-host Wes Roberts. Please join us every Sunday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Time as we explore ufology and beyond. And remember, we are not alone. Good night, everyone.